All right, great. So thanks for having me here, as always. So I think I want to start by just writing down the main theorem that I want to talk about, and then I'll explain what all the words mean and try to put it in some context. This is a joint result with Saab & Coates. And the statement is about the Grothendieck ring of the category of equivariant coherent sheaves on the affine Grassmannian in type A. So here's some category with a monoidal structure, and the claim is that its Grothendieck ring is the quantum cluster algebra of type, so whatever a cluster algebra is, it's something that's labeled by a quiver. So I draw the quiver that's relevant to the theorem. So N is the labeling of our group, and I'm going to take N minus 1 pairs of vertical arrows, and I'm going to stitch them together in this way. Okay, so here's a statement about algebras, and all cluster monomials are classes of simple perverse coherent sheaves. Okay, so I have a lot of words to define here. But before I get to doing that, let me just start with a remark, which is that the algebraic part of the statement, that such and such algebra is isomorphic to such and such other algebra, is actually an earlier result of, or a quantization of an earlier result of Finkelberg, Kuznetsov, and Rybnikov. So our interest is really in the sort of categorical part of the statement. So that there is this special category of perverse coherent sheaves, which is the coherent Satake category of the title, and that that category categorifies a certain sort of structure on this ring that one can define independently. Okay, so let me begin with the sort of geometric characters in the statement. So what is the affine Grassmannian and what are perverse coherent sheaves? So let's say that I have a simple algebraic group G. Over the complex numbers, and I'll write so script K is notation for the ring of Laurent series in a variable Z. O is going to be the ring of formal power series in Z. So the affine Grassmannian of G, which I'll write as Ger G, this is the quotient of the group of K-valued points of G by the group of O-valued points. So for example, if G is a general linear group, which isn't simple, but it's close enough, then these are just the groups of invertible matrices with series entries, power and Laurent series, respectively. So this is the geometric object we want to study. It's an infinite dimensional object. I want to give you a matrix with series entries. I have to give you infinitely many numbers. But this quotient is in some sense controlled by finite dimensional geometry. So that's a a union, an increasing union of finite dimensional projective varieties. And an obvious question to ask about it is, on this quotient, I still have the left action of G of O, and the orbits of that action are countable. So in fact, the left G of O orbits, these are labeled by co-characters, co-weights, so homomorphisms from C star into a maximal torus of G. To conjugation. So let's do the simplest example we can possibly think of. Let's just talk about what is GER PGL2. It's also the simplest example relevant to the theorem. So here I've asserted that this has an orbit decomposition labeled by homomorphisms from C star to maximal torus of PGL2, which is just C star. So that's an integer, those are classified by the integers. Consider those up to conjugation. That's conjugation by a permutation matrix. So I have integers up to multiplication by plus minus one. So the orbits are just gonna be labeled by natural numbers. And under that labeling, the corresponding number just corresponds to the dimension of an orbit. So there's a unique zero-dimensional orbit. There's a unique one-dimensional orbit, which is a copy of the projective line. And those are the only two closed orbits, and the rest of them sort of expand outward. So this zero-dimensional piece is in the closure of the two-dimensional orbit. Both of those are in the closure of the four-dimensional orbit, so on and so forth. And the same thing over in this other connected component. So this P1 is in the closure of the three-dimensional orbit, which is in the closure of the five-dimensional orbit, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the kind of object that we're studying. And what do I want to study about it? So I want to talk about coherent sheaves on this. So what's it? By a coherent sheaf or an equivariant coherent sheaf on GER G, I just mean a coherent sheaf on one of these finite dimensional pieces, which I can then say, so like an algebraic vector bundle on one of these closure of some orbit. And then I could push that forward to some larger orbit if I wanted to see a bigger piece of GER G. So there's a special kind of coherent sheaf or complex thereof that we want to consider. So this was, these were first considered by Bezrukhovnikov, Finkelberg, and Mirkovich. So let's, we're going to be working in the category of G of O equivariant coherent sheaves on GER G. And really, I want to talk about complexes. I'll take the derived category of that. And we say that F, a sheaf, a complex, and here is perverse. If for all orbits, so let me write an orbit for the co-weight lambda as GER lambda. All right, I of lambda for the inclusion of that orbit. So if for every orbit, the pullbacks I lambda upper star of F and I lambda upper shriek of F. So if I want to pull back a sheaf to a subvariety, there's two different ways I could do that, which in this case roughly correspond to say first cutting down the size of the sheaf by respectively tensoring or taking a HOM with the structure sheaf of the closure. So there's two kinds of pullbacks I consider. And I want these to respectively have cohomology only in certain degrees. So only in degrees respectively less and greater than. Minus 1/2 the dimension of that orbit. Okay, so here's the definition, and at no point in the rest of the talk will you have to actually have processed this definition. Instead, you just have to process the following assertion of these people, which is that these form, if I look at all of the perverse objects, these form a finite length abelian subcategory, the heart of a T-structure on dbCo, which I'll write as pCo So I have a finite length abelian category. That means that every object in there is built out of is a finite extension of the simple objects. And in particular, it follows that the simple objects, or the classes of those objects, form a basis in K-theory. So I get a basis in K-theory from this T-structure, and it's also, it's an abelian, it's a tensor category. So there's a convolution product on G of O equivariant sheaves. Whenever you look at equivariant things on a group that are biequivariant for some subgroup, there's a natural convolution product. So in particular, I have a monoidal structure from convolution. Okay, so what's an example of one of these perverse coherent sheaves? So the simplest thing to do is consider the restriction. So Gur of G is sort of an infinite dimensional projective. Yeah. So Gur G has Picard group is isomorphic to the integers, so I can consider the restriction of a global line bundle O of n to the closure of some orbit, and then take that restriction and shift it in an appropriate cohomological degree in degree minus 1/2 dimension of Gur lambda. So a funny little formal thing that we need to do is we'll actually consider complexes that are that take values in half integer degrees, not just integer group degrees. Okay, so here's a simple example of a simple object, and those are all of the simple examples. So if in general, if I describing what these simple objects actually are is something that's there's no sort of easy direct way to compute that, but there is a direct classification. So simple objects in general are classified by simple equivariant vector bundles on orbits. So this statement the bijection takes the form, if you have a simple equivariant vector bundle on some orbit, there is a unique simple perverse coherent sheaf whose support is the closure of that orbit and whose restriction to that, to the orbit itself, is the given simple vector bundle. But if you start with just the vector bundle, computing what that extension is a complicated thing to do. But I have this labeling, and if you sort of reflect a little bit on what this labeling, what the underlying data is, I have to give you an orbit, which we've said is given by a coweight. I have to give you that equivariant vector bundle, which is given by a weight of G. So basically, I have to give you a weight and a coweight up to the overall action of the vial group. Okay, so there's a nice classification of simple objects. But as I was saying, it's not at all obvious, given one of these labels, even how to compute, say, the class of the corresponding simple object in K-theory, say, in terms of some generating set of K-naughts in algebra. So what this theorem is about, on one level, is asserting the existence of a particular kind of algorithm, which can be couched sort of without referring to the underlying geometry for a G, but there exists a certain kind of algorithm for some computing some non-trivial infinite subset of this basis that we get in K-theory. All right, so any questions about the Grassmanni and then coherent sheaves before we move on? Yeah. If the coweight is minuscule, then I think all of the simples supported on that will turn out to be of this form. So then it's nice, yes. And in general, you're of that form so there's a map, the bilinear pairing gives you a map from coweights to weights. And if your pair is a coweight and then a multiple of the image of that coweight under this map, then you're of that form. Yeah, absolutely. The way I interpret your question, that was sort of a tautology.
Sure, but I just wanted to kind of picture, I guess, what was going on.
When you say the... You're anticipating me later on talking about the BD Grassmannian, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We will defy the gods and continue proceed with the talk. Okay. So let me just explain what all this cluster terminology is about. Okay, so this is some formalism for that takes the following shape. So there's a construction of, given a quiver Q, a certain algebra, A sub Q, that comes equipped with a basis, a special basis, or in general, just a special sort of part of a basis. So some big linearly independent set. And the form of the structure has the following flavor. So AQ is generated by special elements of this would-be basis called cluster variables. Which are so named because they cluster into certain overlapping subsets. And these subsets are sort of characterized by the properties that if I take a monomial in the elements of any cluster, these are again elements of the basis, any cluster. Okay, so right off the bat, the kind of thing that the theorem is saying is that, okay, by studying perverse coherent sheaves, you get some sort of a priori, very mysterious basis in K-naught, but actually that basis partially decomposes into a bunch of little pieces that are very simple. They just look like polynomial subrings, but they're standard monomial basis. So here's, let's see, so things have conveniently transpired so that right above our picture of GERPGL2, I can describe what is the cluster algebra associated to the quiver Q2. So Q2 is just the two Kronecker quiver, two vertices and two arrows. So what exactly explicitly is this algebra? This is just, it's some subring of Laurent polynomials in two variables, call them x1 and x2. So I've said that this algebra is defined via some big generating set. So let me tell you that generating set. These are going to be labeled by integers in a way that extends the labeling of our generators of the Laurent ring. So I have a set x sub I, where I is some integer. I asserted that the theorem could be thought of as saying there's an algorithm for computing a bunch of things. That algorithm is expressed in terms of certain relations, which take the form xi minus 1 times xi plus 1 is equal to xi squared plus 1. Okay, so if I wanted to compute, say, what x 1 million was, well, this relation tells me what x3 is in terms of x1 and x2. I apply it again, and I learn what x4 is in terms of x2 and x3, and I iterate that process, and I could figure out what x whatever you like is. Oh, and you looked. Yeah, okay. Okay, so I can compute sort of, so iteratively. Yeah, please.
Like x1 should be thought of as x1 here?
That is definition for x3. Like the start of some induction, and I'm saying I'm going to define some list of other elements by applying this relation ad infinitum. And then just look at what you get, yeah.
So I think if this relation is two or two primes become minimum.
No, you should think of that as a relation about, because ultimately this relation is going to be some exact sequence in this tensor category. It's going to say you collide these two lines. So it's going to tell you how you push two particular sort of Wilson tufts that are close together. How does that decompose?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and so I said the other part of the game was there's this grouping. So these subsets are just the subsets of adjacent pairs. Okay, so there's explicitly what this algebra is. And what's sort of, how is this representative of the general structure? Well, I called these exchange relations because so in general, once my quiver has more than two vertices, the variables are no longer going to be indexed by integers. But let's say that I pick some cluster and label them just x1 through xn, then I can exchange one of those, xk, to get a new cluster. Where I swap out xk for some xk prime with xk prime determined purely by the quiver.
Sure. You use the word n over there, and then use the word n for n minus 1, and here you're using the
Wait, okay, I see one bad N. This should be an M. Where's the other bad? Oh, that should be an M. Where's my other inconsistent?
It's the statement of your theorem, N is N minus 1.
Ah, thank you, thank you. Yes.
The M here for these particular ones is 2N minus 2. Is that right? There's a cluster of the variable for each vertex.
That's correct, that's right. So the number of elements in any cluster, just as in the example, is the number of vertices in this quiver. And sort of all, I get all clusters by just iterating this process as far as I like.
So, are you going to explain how the exact size of the device with the geometry gap you
specify? Yes, yes, in a sec. Yeah, so let me. So in answer to Kevin's question, let me go ahead and say, so let's call this, so we already mentioned the simplest example of a perverse coherent sheaf. Sometimes I'll fall back and call the simple object coherent IC sheaves. But let's call this P sub lambda of N. And in our favorite example here, so this variable xk, so where does xk go under the isomorphism here? Well, it goes to just the class of this p sub omega 1, where omega 1 is the fundamental weight, or the fundamental co-weight of PGL2 of k. Okay, so here we can be as explicit as you could possibly want. The class of... That's right. So here, I mean, like, this P1 is Gur omega 1. And more generally for, as I didn't write, but was stated in the discussion, so in general, there's some sort of... things are defined in terms of some sort of initial cluster. Elements in there are labeled by vertices of the quiver. So what are the classes that are appearing here? Well, I have the class of, as in this example, P omega 1, say just of 0, just the structure sheaf, P omega 1 of 1. And then the other sort of steps here just change what the weight we're looking at is. So I have the class of P omega 2 of 0, P omega 2 of 1, and so on and so forth. Okay, so in this sort of initial cluster, all of the simple sheaves we're talking about are, again, nice. So for the PGLN case, the picture is similar, but instead of a P1 here, I have several components, the closed orbits of which are just the various Grassmannians of K-planes in N-space. And these are line bundles supported on those closed orbits. But what is misleading about the N equals 2 case is that for 3 and bigger, sort of most cluster variables are not going to be supported on closed orbits, and they're not going to be the sort of nice objects we got over there. Somehow they're... there are things whose geometry is something we can't access so directly.
You just told us what a cluster algebra is. Mm-hmm. What's the adjective quantum?
Oh, thank you. So there's a, just for purposes of sort of being able to write down the example in elementary terms, I stated things in terms of non-quantum cluster algebras. There's a canonical deformation of such an object. And so a part of the statement, which I'm not really stressing, is that when I consider the quantum algebra, that corresponds on the geometric side to turning. There's a canonical quantization on the cluster side. There's a canonical quantization on the geometric side, which is turn on equivariance for the loop rotation parameter. So part of the statement is that those are those quantizations agree. But I'm, as I said, this somehow the that's not the Q deformation is a little bit orthogonal to the main story as I'm telling it. Okay, so so I said that most of the sort of classes that are implicated in the theorem are difficult to say anything about directly. So how on earth do you go about proving such a statement? And sort of why should such a thing be true? So I mean, when I wrote down this sort of vague description of what a cluster algebra is, it wasn't meant to look intuitive, it was meant to look weird. And so you say, well, okay, why does this basis of perverse coherent sheaves, why does it have this weird shape? And the answer to both questions is comes from the role of factorization. So on a sort of practical level, so this category of coherent sheaves, as came up earlier in Owen's question, the affine Grassmannian sort of fits into some larger structure called the Balanchine-Drinfeld Grassmannian. And the upshot of that is that this tensor category of perverse coherent sheaves also has a compatible chiral or factorization structure. So the moral is going to be that this isn't just an arbitrary tensor category we're straining, but the existence of that factorization structure constrains the tensor product in a very strong way. And this sort of cluster structure is a kind of consequence of that constraint. So this is a theme that sort of we drew by analogy with some separate work. So let me state a really sort of fundamental result of Kang, Kashiwara, Kim, and Oh. So their theorem is the following. So under the isomorphism, so I'm going to write something that looks formally similar to what we wrote over there. There's going to be the Groton decoding of some category. But now this is going to be the category of modules, not of the something to do with the affine Grassmannian, but the category of modules over the KLR algebras of type G. So the definition isn't going to be too important for us. But there's some family of algebras that are associated to the positive roots of G. And if I look at the direct sum of all of those module categories, there's a natural convolution product there. So there's some sort of monoidal category. One of the reasons for being interested in this is that it categorifies the positive unipotent subgroup of G. So say the group of upper triangular matrices in type A. And this is something that, again, this sort of this has its own cluster structure. So this sort of simple, I'll just write QG for the quiver. It doesn't matter what it is. But this has a cluster structure whose sort of simple basis elements are just like restrictions of minors. So their theorem is that that cluster structure, so all cluster monomials, are classes of simple KLR modules. So the corresponding basis in here that's induced by the simple objects, this was something that was, this is some technology that was in some sense invented to study this basis here, which is the so-called, the famous dual canonical basis of Lustig and Kashiwara. So this theorem kind of solved a longstanding sort of conjecture that, which really motivated the discovery of this whole formalism, was that in the course of studying canonical basis in this context of just positive unipotent groups or their enveloping algebras and quantizations, that that basis has this particular sort of combinatorial shape. Theo, you look a little unhappy. Okay. So they proved this big theorem. It looks like the theorem that we're trying to prove. So what did they do? Well, the proof is pretty is rather technical, but there's a key piece of structure. So in general, I said there's some monoidal structure on this direct sum of categories. And in general, there's no isomorphism between the tensor products of two modules in opposite orders. So this category has no hope of being symmetric or braided, but there's a non-zero best approximation to a braiding. That's right. So there's another funny thing going on here, which is that you're right, nonetheless. So this is not a symmetric monoidal category, but its Grothendieck ring is symmetric. So if I compare these two tensor products, their compositions are the same, composition series are the same, but they're pasted together in different ways. So there's a best approximation to, which I'll write as RMN, to a braiding. And the how is this defined? Well, it's defined by deforming M and N over the affine line. All right, so as was anticipated in Owen's question earlier, well, the affine Grassmannian also sort of deforms in a certain way over the affine line and over the powers of the affine line or any other curve that I like. So we can construct the same kind of structure. Yeah, notice another thing, which I guess I didn't say. So, in particular, the non-quantum version of this result, I remove the equivariance. So again, this is not a, this is a sort of strongly non-symmetric category as well. Different orders of tensor products are not isomorphic. Nonetheless, this is a commutative ring. And part of the reason for why that's true and the way that we can construct this map is via the Balin-Sindrin-Velgrassmannian. So this is a, for every power of the affine line, Cn, I have a an in-schemed Ger-Cn G. I'll sort of start being lazy and suppressing the G. So this is a, I have this family of in-schemes, and this has a certain kind of structure. So this is sort of prototypical example of a factorization space. So that means, so that's, means a number of things. The sort of things that that's saying is that, for example, if I look at Ger C2, so this is some family of in schemes over C2. If I look off of the diagonal, all right, delta for the diagonal, this just looks like, or maybe let me say one quick thing here. So Ger C, this is just a sort of trivial thing. Ger C2 is not trivial, but I can describe it sort of easily in terms of Ger C. So away from the diagonal, this is isomorphic to Ger C cross Ger C. Whereas on the diagonal, so the diagonal itself just looks like some copy of C, and this Ger C2 on the diagonal just looks like Ger C.
Two potential questions.
This is yet another N, yeah.
Great. And how
can these two are given as part of the data. This one was something that I just picked. Okay, so I have this, so the affine Grassmannian fits into this larger factorization space structure. So how, why does that sort of tell us something about convolution products of coherent sheaves? Well, let's play the following game. So if I so let's say I have F and G, two coherent sheaves on Kerr G, and let's start by just extending them to two sheaves F bar and G bar on Ger C. So sort of say you could just take the constant family of them. So I can consider those extensions, and I can sort of fuse those, I can take an outer product of those two extensions and look at that on C2. So I want to do that, but actually I want to do something a little bit different. I want to look at so I'm going to look at two sheaves on C2. I'm going to study homomorphisms between them as a sheaf over C2, or as a module over polynomials in two variables. And let's look at the following thing. So I can take our extension. I can look at its outer product not with G, but with the monoidal, with the unit, which is just the structure sheaf on C, sort of times the constant sheaf over here. I can study the convolution product of that with the similar outer product, but with G, and in the other order. And I want to look at the product, the HOM between these two things, where I permute the order now of the convolution product. So a little sort of piece of structure that I didn't write down, but I'm invoking here. So what an outer product is something that makes sense for this sort of product of Ger-C's. But actually, if I take that product with the unit on one side, that extends over the diagonal to a sheaf on Ger-C2, which on the diagonal just looks like the sheaf which is not a unit. So this is something that away from the diagonal looks like F on one factor, looks like the unit on the other factor, and on the diagonal it looks like F. Okay, so what? What can we say about this this HOM space? Well, on the complement of the diagonal, so this convolution product sort of doesn't just treats these two factors independently. So on one side I have HOM from F times the unit, which is just F, outer the unit times G, which is just G. And the same thing on the other side. Unit times F is still F. And then I have G. Okay, so in particular, this is a canonical non-vanishing section, just the identity map. Meanwhile, what's going on the diagonal? Well, we said that on the diagonal, this just looks like F, and this just looks like G. So under this isomorphism, what we're studying is HOM from F convolved with G to, on the other side, now G convolved with F. Okay. So if it happened that the non-vanishing section that we constructed here, if it happened that that section extended across the diagonal and had a non-zero value, then I could just take the stock of that, and I would have exactly the kind of map that we're trying to produce. But these are coherent sheaves on C2. So if I have some non-vanishing section there, I can multiply it by a, by, there's some power of z1 minus z2 I can multiply it by to get something that extends and doesn't vanish. So I multiply by some power of z1 minus z2 to get an extension. And if you sort of keep kind of iterating this process to think about sort of not just this map, but the kernel and the co-kernel of that map, you can sort of build further maps and see exactly this fact that the composition series of the two factors are the same. Hence, in K-theory there, you get a commutative ring. Okay, so there's this map. And why is it useful for the theorem? Well, so there's so many good properties. So what's maybe the most important one? So if F, let's say that F, G, and F convolve with itself, suppose these are all simple. And it follows that the image of R sub FG is simple. Okay. So in other words, just understanding formal features of this map, I have a mechanism for creating new simple objects out of old ones without needing to, for example, describe this object explicitly as some complex of coherent sheaves. So that's why this map is kind of an engine for saying things about simple objects. That's this sort of near braiding, and I'm saying it's this thing that you get by extend this section to the diagonal, and now take a stock at a point. Okay, so so there's what this map is and why it should be plausibly a useful structure for saying something about simple objects. And if you sort of, if you reflect on this, the sort of, the proof of this theorem that I just erased and sort of read what they do and think about, well, how far can this argument be pushed, you realize that that's sort of all you need. So let's say I have C, let's say I have a chiral tensor category. So informally for the talk, just think that this is something that behaves formally like perverse coherent sheaves, given that I have this deformation. More generally, there's some recent foundational work of Sam Raskin setting up the general theory of chiral DG categories. So you could formalize this as a chiral category in that sense with some compatible structure, an E1 structure and a T structure, and some finiteness conditions. But if I have something that sort of behaves well enough to run this sort of argument, and this is over, so now I want to, for purposes of stating the theorem again, I'm going to turn back on C star covariance, but sort of blur your eyes and ignore this if you like. It's over such that there exists a map of some cluster algebra or some quantum cluster algebra into the Grothendieck ring of C, or the stock of C at a point, like P co. There exists a map with all monomials in a single cluster it's one step mutations. So we said earlier, if I have a cluster, I have this, I can exchange an element to get a new cluster. Just look at the finite number of clusters you get by just doing one exchange. So suppose that all of those cluster variables and all of the monomials in those clusters, suppose these are all classes of simple objects. So in particular, this is a finite amount of data that you have to check. Then all cluster monomials are classes of simple objects. OK, so here's now the sort of general theorem that you can, that leads to the kind of theorem that we said at the beginning. And again, because that initial cluster that we were working with only involves sort of easy objects we could get our hands on, just line bundles on closed orbits, I can compute the finite part of the statement and now deduce the rest as a sort of formal consequence of the factorization structure. Yeah, so one thing that you should, I mean, there's a sort of general principle based on the kind of zoology of 4ED n equals 2 theories. But I mean, a little bit better of an answer is that, so you should, this hypothesis looks and is sort of awkward, but it really shouldn't be essential. So the hypothesis that you have some map like this you should be able to drop this but this requires understanding how to read off a potential from this tensor category. So we've been trying to figure out how to do this. There's a few things we can say, but it's kind of hard.
What kind of objects are the potential? It's like it's something living in
which country? Concretely, it's like a formal sum of oriented cycles on that quiver. So the general sort of statement that one should imagine is this: suppose I have a chiral tensor category, and suppose I have a cluster in the sense that, like, what is the sort of, if I have a sort of the sort of algebraic notion of a cluster, I have some simple objects, and the classes of those things are again in the basis. I'm saying you have a collection of simple objects such that when you take their any convolution product of those, I still get a simple object. So there's a sort of categorical notion of some class of objects that your tensor category might contain. Now, suppose that you can, so now say, imagine I have that, and imagine that I can sort of remove one of those objects and sort of replace it in some way. So what the general statement says, sort of without this assumption, would be that, okay, first of all, by looking at the relations of those new things, you can now reverse engineer what that quiver is. And so the general statement that would say, sort of because you have this chiral structure, you necessarily are able to iterate that mutation process. But you might not be able to iterate it along a sort of arbitrary sequence of mutations. In general, maybe only along a subset of those in a way that is constrained by a particular potential on that quiver. Okay, so that's the general thing that one should expect, both at a theoretical level and sort of in the sort of guts of how this proof works. you see that the only place you need to use this hypothesis are the places where one might get in trouble if there were a potential. I mean, so this is sort of local statement around any point.
Oh, so, I'm, well, I thought, well, when you said C under the C star, I thought there was like zero, which is the fixed point.
Oh, yeah, thanks. So here I really want to be zero. Again, if so, also the sort of necessity of considering C star equivariant things, that's again kind of a crutch for not understanding how potentials should fit into the picture. So that shouldn't be too essential. So that's sort of the story, maybe just, so I haven't said anything about like physical context for this, but I've also been talking for a while. Maybe I should let people go. I've talked for an hour, so. Yeah.
I think that means Harold's gonna not blame you if you leave.
That's right.
Tell us what this is.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so now I'm just going to sort of assemble some facts to explain sort of, you know, why would one, yeah, how should one think about this? So the sort of setting we're in is going to be something that was introduced by Kapustin and also studied in work with Salina. So there's a holomorphic, so he introduced the holomorphic topological twist. Of 4D, really n equals two gauge theory, but we're going to be talking about n equals two pure gauge theory. So this is a holomorphic topological field theory. And they studied the sort of features of this theory that we're interested in are, so they explained that there should be a monoidal DG category of line operators along, so here we're talking about some theory, it's topological on some plane R2, holomorphic on another plane C, and we study lines that are sort of extended along this, some line, operators on some line in the topological plane. Say pick some point Z and C and look at some line. So this has a monoidal structure given by, if I have two parallel lines, I can sort of bring them together. And they suggested that there's another thing I can study, which is the algebra of loop operators. On a similar thing, but instead of R, I look at S1. So I'm looking at the theory on S1 cross R cross C. And he said that the relation between these should just be taking the Grothendieck ring. And this algebra of, so in gauge theory, you can write down a bunch of natural loop operators. So these sort of special loop operators are the Wilson-Tufts. These should form a basis. In this algebra of loop operators. And again, these are, so note, these are labeled by weight, co-weight pairs. OK, so here are some expectations you should have of this particular holomorphic topological field theory on R2 cross C2. And Kevin is nice enough to tell you exactly what this category should be. So this is just coherent sheaves on, or DG category of coherent sheaves on GERD G. Let me make a note that, or okay, let me say one more thing and then I'll make a note. Okay, so here's some sort of general things about line and loop operators in this holomorphic twist. Now there's a sort of other paradigm, something else we know about loop operators in N equals 2 theories from work of Davide and Knightsky Moore is that in many N equals 2 theories, in 4D, loop operators are partly captured or described by cluster algebra. And in this context, so cluster algebra is associated with some quiver, and this quiver is what's called the so-called BPS quiver theory. Which in the case of if we're looking at SUN, n equals 2 gauge theory, this is exactly the quiver that I wrote down at the beginning of the talk, which is QN for SUN gauge theory. OK, so if you put together all the facts I've written on the board, this should be, what would you think? You would think, okay, I know that I can sort of build by writing down a bunch of loop operators a basis in this loop algebra. Well, that's supposed to be K naught of this other category. How do you get bases in Grothendieck groups of things? You get them from finite length T structures, okay? So if there's some special basis, probably it corresponds to some finite length T structure. On the other hand, I know that simple loop operators are supposed to be described by cluster algebra of the BPS quiver. So this sort of most obvious finite length T structure I have on GERD G should be described by this particular quiver. What are the morals? Well, okay, we sort of learn from the point of view of this sort of algebra-geometric setup of the Grassmannian, sort of what the meaning of Wilson-Tufts are simple. They're described by this perverse T structure. And this was sort of, this suggestion kind of appears in a vague form already in this work of Kapustin and Solana, but in sort of hidden way. And so another sort of, so there's a basic thing, and another kind of takeaway from the proof is that the a lot of the sort of conceptual understanding behind sort of why do cluster structures appear in n equals two theories, the sort of a lot of the sort of understanding of that comes from a sort of six-dimensional or stringy perspective. And in the proof of this sort of statement, what you learn is that actually that structure is largely forced upon you just by the sort of four-dimensional, just by sort of formal properties of holomorphic topological field theory. Because this notion of a chiral tensor category is exactly encoding the kind of structure you expect to have on line operators in such a twist. So the chiral structure is just saying, not only can I collide lines here, but I can move this point Z around. So appearance of clusters, so you get a sort of holomorphic topological sort of perspective on why clusters appear in this context of 40 n equals 2 theory. Okay, so now I will really shut up. Which spaces of morphisms? I would say they're hard to compute. Yeah. You don't, in the course of the proof, you don't really, I mean, everything that you sort of learn, you learn by sort of formal properties of this R matrix. And sometimes you can say, well, okay, if I have some objects and I know a little bit about their tensor product, and I have some other simples I'm trying to study, you can often say things about like when, you know, when is the socle of a, you can often identify socles of things fairly explicitly. And so if I know something about the socle of some sort of some complicated object, and I have some other, you know, if I know that say that socle doesn't appear in the composition series of something else, I can deduce that there can't be an interesting map between them. So that's the kind of reasoning that's the kind of thing you can see, but sort of in terms of direct geometric computations of things, that's quite difficult.
So not even like Olaf Kreisman software, the Olaf character of the space.
No, yeah, and computing X, I really don't know how to do. The X are more complicated. Because the Homs, at least, you can compute on like a finite dimensional piece. But if I embed, you know, one of the finite dimensional pieces into a larger orbit closure, you know, the X groups start to grow as I look at them inside this bigger space. So that computation is really, it's not clear how to approach that, to me at least. I mean, you have to compute some simple Homs to sort of get off the ground. You have to know something about the mutations of these. And the only reason you can really do that is because you have a very explicit model of the, yeah, if you have some computation you want to do that only involves these smooth closed orbits, the convolution varieties involved are also sort of natural iterated projective bundles. So you can compute some push forwards pretty explicitly there, but beyond that, it gets hairy. Sorry?
Are these coherent shifts, coherent shifts, the same as paramagnetic geometric solves that associate to the corresponding?
I mean, it's the same. I mean, the Grothendieck rings that, yeah. I mean, Equivarian K homology that they compute in terms of, I don't think, I think even saying what is the right DG category there, the last time I talked to Sasha, he sounded like that was already confusing, and let alone trying to define what is the a natural T structure on those categories. Because once you're outside of the sort of infinite type world, the definition of the perverse T structure a priori doesn't make sense because you can't refer to dimensions of things anymore. So you really have to have some new idea to understand what the right T structure is there. Well, adding matter, again, is taking you out of the infinite case, so.
How specific can you compute your matrix?
Well, it depends what you mean. What do you, like, what do you want to compute explicitly? I mean, because you're learning, insofar as you, you're getting a state, like once you have a statement about the relations between some big collection of simple objects, and you learn something about, you know, like typically the R matrix is going to be a unique map between two things. So in that sense, you know it completely. But if there's a more specific question you want to ask, then it depends on what this question is.
I suppose I was wondering if you might produce an integral system a little bit like Felder's integral system, but now with a Max relation. Can you see it and connect with the integral system?
I mean, it's also a little bit funny calling it an R matrix because, you know, there's no, I mean, in the KLR setting, they sort of use that notation, and it makes sense because you literally have vector spaces, and I have a map of vector spaces. Here you're talking about R matrices between these coherent sheaves. So if you want to talk about R matrices in the integral system sense, a priori I would need an interpretation of that R matrix as really a map of vector spaces.
Oh, this does appear, though. In Felder's one, he has a Young-Baxter equation with a dynamical parameter,
uh-huh.
And instead of being vector spaces, they're sheaves and
Okay. I don't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are sort of, there are some braid type relations that you get. So insofar as you have those relations, that's some, should get you something like Young-Baxter.
So if you get some generic weight and co-weight,
mm-hmm.
So the corresponding function
Mm-hmm.
Is there a systematic way to build the corresponding complex?
Yeah, no, I don't know. And I don't, I mean, maybe, for example, a more basic question that I don't know, which is, I mean, there's some long list of weight coweight pairs that corresponds to cluster monomials, so to things that, you know, their tensor square is simple. Describe that list explicitly as just a condition on weights and co-weights. I don't know how to do that. So if you ask me sort of your question, well, okay, if it's at least the class of a real object, then maybe then there's some hope maybe. But as soon as you sort of ask about something that sort of isn't implicated in the theorem, then I have no more information than I had at the beginning of the day. Aside from I know a little bit about tensor products are constrained in a special way.
I suggest we thank Carol together that continue to ask questions to the board.